We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
Galatians chapters 1 and 2. Jesus said, "Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you, and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man." He also said, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for that is how their fathers treated the false prophets." Now, Christianity is not a club for paranoids, the hated scum of the universe or something like that. And the verses of Jesus are not an excuse for Christians to be nasty, hostile, unpleasant people. We may be that, but those verses do not excuse us in being like that. But Jesus challenges us at a very sensitive point, for we all love to be loved. We all worship popularity. And so we're all led by the nose by the whims and fashions of the mob around about us. Yet Jesus says that the real joys of life can be found in unpopularity. That is the exact reverse of normal wisdom. The real blessing comes, of course, if our unpopularity is for the right reason. Blessed are you when men speak evil of you because of the Son of Man. Woe to you when men speak well of you, for that is how they treated the false prophets. If for the sake of the gospel, we are spoken badly of, we are reviled and hated and unpopular, then indeed we are blessed. Then indeed we have the real joy that comes from God, because the gospel has a stench about it. For those who are being saved, it has the sweet perfume of salvation, of heaven itself, of life and all that life can hold. But for those who are perishing, it has about it the pungent odour of death. Thus, preaching the gospel will always divide a community. And dividing the community will lead to unpopularity. In football and other ball games, some people play the ball and some people play the man, who may or may not be carrying the ball if it's rugby league. It is usually easier to go for the preacher than to go for the gospel. If you want to attack a point of view, attack the man who holds that point of view. He's usually an easier mark. So when any Christian openly proclaims Christ, you can expect that that Christian will be publicly and privately attacked and slandered, as Paul was and as Paul still is. Yet the beauty of the attacks that come against Paul in particular, but Christians in general, is that they heighten and clarify the issues of the gospel. For it is as the opposition arises and the attack is levelled against Paul that Paul outlines his defence, and as he outlines his defence, he outlines with clarity the gospel issues that are being attacked. Paul is still under attack today, as he was in the first century. Today, still people do not like Paul. Still people go on about the simple Jesus, the Galilean king, lovely, kindly teaching about the love of God. And the hard, cold, arrogant Pharisaic Paul, legalistic and theological, who confused it all up with complexities because he never understood the gospel of Jesus, because he wasn't really a Jesus disciple, he was a Pharisee, perverted in mind. He is the one, he has seen, who brings in such nastiness as the wrath of God and so forth. Both those views are appalling caricatures. It's an appalling caricature of Jesus, just as it is of Paul. Jesus is not simple, not in his teaching. It is highly sophisticated teaching. Try and explain the gospel sometime to somebody and you will see how incredibly sophisticated are the arguments of Jesus. And who is it that preaches on hell in the New Testament most commonly? It is Jesus. The words on his lips more often than on any other person in the whole Bible. He is the greatest hellfire preacher in the whole 66 books. Jesus is the one who teaches us about hell. It is hardly mentioned by the other writers, such as Paul. And Paul's hardly a cold and arrogant man. You read his story, you read his epistles in, say, Romans 9, 10 and 11, with his great burning compassion for the people of Israel, his own people, who seem to be so lost. There is little of the arrogance of the man in Philippians, who sees that all that he has achieved in this world is only worth the rubbish dump for the surpassing knowledge of Jesus Christ. No, he is not like that man. He is not like his caricature any more than Jesus is. But in his own day, as in today, Paul was attacked because he preached the gospel. What was he attacked about in his own day? Many things. But in the Epistle to the Galatians, we can perceive that he is attacked as being not genuine as an apostle. And also, he is attacked because he is too Jewish, if you're a Gentile, and too Gentile, if you're a Jew. But his attitudes to the Jews and to the Gentiles came consistently under attack. Paul sees it for what it is. He sees it as an attack on the gospel, not so much on his own self. And therefore he defends himself more vigorously, not because he has been personally slighted, but because the gospel is held in question when he is under such attack. And so, let's look briefly at the attacks on Paul. Firstly, as to his apostolicity, whether he was an apostle. And secondly, as to whether or not he was truly Jewish or had become too Gentile. How can he be questioned as an apostle? Well, he was not a follower from the beginning, was he? We don't know of him knowing Jesus in Jesus' lifetime. When in chapter 1 of Acts, the 11 disciples come apostles, elect a 12th member, they lay down as a precondition that he must have been someone who has been with us from the beginning, as well as some other things. Must be a witness of the resurrection and so forth. And there's only two men who fit the bill, and so they cast lots for him, and our blessed St. Matthias won the lottery. St. Matthias can be elected because he had been with Jesus from the very beginning, but Paul had not been with Jesus from the beginning. He wasn't converted till some years later. He was an outsider to the original group. He was a latecomer. He describes himself in 1 Corinthians 15 as someone who was abnormally born. He actually describes himself in fairly graphic words there. He says, I was aborted. I was a fetus not yet ready for birth and popped out. It was born out of season, as one of the translations tries to capture it. You see, he was not like all the others. His timing was radically different. And also, the Jerusalemites were said to be unhappy about him. And men from Jerusalem, believers in Jesus, so it is said, come to the churches of Galatia as they went throughout the world and would tell stories about the fact that Paul was an unknown back in Jerusalem. The apostles of Jerusalem were Peter and James and John and men like that. They weren't too happy with what this was going on, this Gentile man who was going around. Now, clearly, Peter and James and company, they're authentic apostles. We know about them from the very beginning. They knew Jesus right back in the Galilee days. But who's this late inventor, Paul, coming along with his teachings? Teachings that are different to the teachings of Jerusalemites, different from the apostles back there. And what kind of authority can Paul have that is different to the authority of the apostles back in Jerusalem? If he's not all right with the apostles back in Jerusalem, then he's not all right. For if you're not in the right institution, then you must be wrong, mustn't you? And they are unhappy. That's the secret word that we'd like to press on to you, Galatians, this evening. Let me tell you that secretly, privately, I heard it from some of them themselves. Peter's not happy with what's been going on here. And he's not happy because of what the Jews and the Gentiles see as their relationship with each other. Because Paul, he's doing naughty things with the Gentiles, isn't he? And would you want to quarrel with Peter? There is the line of attack that is levelled against Paul. And it's about this Jew-Gentile question. It's one disease with two symptoms. It's one question that you see reflected in two issues in chapters 1 and 2. One issue is the issue of circumcision, the other is the issue of eating. We'll be looking at eating next week, but tonight's sermon functions as a backdrop to next week's sermon. I'll explain it as we go along a little further. The next week's sermon will be much more specific, much more directed at the gospel. It'll be of a different character, and those who have been this week will benefit enormously from understanding the reason that it has arrived in Galatians chapter 2. But next week we'll be looking very much shorter passage, and we'll be just looking at the eating subject. But the subject for next week on eating and the subject of circumcision were two symptoms of the disease that Paul was said to have. The disease of not being true blue as a Jew. It is strange to our minds, but to the first century men, to be a Gentile Christian was a problem, for a Christian was a follower of the Jewish Messiah. If you're a follower of the Jewish Messiah, should you not become Jewish first, and as a Jew, then follow the Messiah? It was a big issue when the whole world of Christians seemed to be Jewish Christians, as to whether a Gentile could become a Christian without first becoming a Jew. It's kind of funny today, isn't it? Of course, the question's almost reversed today. You almost wonder, is it possible to be a Jew and become a Christian now? Whereas then, it was the exact reverse. Can you be a Gentile and become a Christian? And we see it often in the pages of the New Testament as a problem issue. And it revolved around certain particular symptoms. Circumcision. For circumcision was the sign of being a Jew. It was a sign of being under the covenant of Abraham. It was a sign of accepting the law of Moses. And so, could an uncircumcised man become a Christian? For if an uncircumcised man becomes a Christian, does that mean he doesn't have to worry about Abraham? Does that mean he doesn't have to worry about Moses? Does that mean that he who is a pagan outsider can become a citizen of heaven when the Jewish descendant of Abraham is actually being excluded from the kingdom of heaven? It's a great problem for them. And the question of circumcision is a question that dominates the pages of the New Testament. Paul had people circumcised from time to time. For example, Timothy in Acts chapter 16, which I think occurs after the epistle of the Galatians. But it shows that Paul had Gentiles circumcised. Yet it's also the rumour about that Paul refused to have Gentiles circumcised. And so people say, you see, this Paul, he can't work himself out properly. He circumcises some, he doesn't circumcise others. He allows uncircumcised people to actually become members of the kingdom of heaven and tells them they don't have to worry about it. But yet on other occasions we know he's done it to people. He is a man of inconsistency, as well as a man of a polluter of the nation Israel, for he fellowships with the uncircumcised and calls them brothers. The second symptom is that of eating. For Israel had all kinds of food laws. You can't eat this and you can eat that. And you can eat certain foods at certain times of the year. And you can eat with certain people under certain circumstances if you've done certain ritual washings. But by and large, you shouldn't be eating with the Gentiles, and you certainly shouldn't be eating their kind of food. Paul followed these customs and rules when he was in the Jewish community. But when he was hanging around with his Gentile mates, Well, that was a different story. Word was around that Paul was eating sweet and sour pork down in the Chinese restaurant on a Friday night. Now, Paul's defence against these attacks can be grouped under two headings. Firstly, his argument that his apostleship is independent of Jerusalem. And secondly, his argument that his apostleship is agreeable to the apostles in Jerusalem. Firstly, he says that he is in no way underneath the Jerusalem apostles or dependent upon them or derived from them. He and his message come directly from God. It is to God and only to God to whom he is answerable. Secondly, he says that his message is consistent with and agreeable to the apostles in Jerusalem, for he is in a happy relationship with them. The two arguments seem in some senses to be contradictory. They're not. For on one level he's having to answer the charge of his authority, because there'll be those who are saying that Paul's just set himself up, or Paul is actually only under the authority of the Jerusalemite church, and the Jerusalemite church disapproves of him. So he has to answer those kinds of attacks. On the other hand, he has to answer the attacks of the people who say, well, of course, that's Paul's message, but have you heard Peter's message? Because Peter's message is different to Paul's message. And of course, we know which one is the authentic one, don't we? Come back to Jerusalem. Firstly, then, his independence. Paul was called, verse 1, chapter 1, to be an apostle not by any man, but by Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised Jesus from the dead. That is his claim. His apostolic status was independent of human authority, just as the gospel he preached was independent of human authority, because it was God's gospel, not man's gospel. Verse 11, I want you to know, brothers, that the gospel I preached is not something that man made up. I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it. Rather, I received it by revelation from Jesus Christ. This message I proclaim to you is God's message, not man's message. And he demonstrates that that is the case by showing the history of his life, that in that he did not receive this message from men. Look at the evidence prior to my conversion, he would say. Did I receive the gospel of Jesus prior to my conversion from men? No, what was I prior to my conversion? I was a persecutor of the church. Any Christian I met up with, I tried to destroy. I really didn't learn the gospel from the Christians before I was converted. Verses 13 and 14, I was intensely Judaistic, persecuted the church of God, advanced in Judaism beyond many of my Jews. I was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers. Paul is not a man who had any associations of a positive nature with Christians before he was converted. Look at the evidence from my conversion, he says. Did my conversion come from the work and activity of men? Did people seek to persuade me of the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Did they share with me tracts and invite me along to church? They didn't invite me to church. The last person they wanted in their churches was Paul. He only went to church in order to stone the Christians. That is a man that we do not usually invite to church. I am very glad if you invite people to church. If it is a Saul of Tarsus kind of man, it would help us to give us a phone call first to warn us of that possibility. This is not a man who is invited to church. No, no. No one set out to evangelize me. But before I was born, God had made his plan to use me. And quoting the story of Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 5, Paul says that God had actually chosen me out before I was born. And at his good time and in his good way, he revealed his son to me. And in revealing his son to me, he called me by his grace. And in calling me by his grace, he sent me to preach to the Gentiles. Those of us who remember the book of Acts remember well the story of Paul on the road to Damascus, Saul of Tarsus as he was then, and how the blinding light came as he was thrust down on the ground and the voice from heaven came, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" And he said, "Who are you, Lord?" And he said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." The last person in the world he expected to see on the road to Damascus was Jesus. He was so sure that Jesus was a fake and phony, that that man would be in hell if he was anywhere, but now he is in heaven. And all my actions of persecution are not just levelled against the church, they're levelled against him. You cannot so totally misread the scene of life than Saul had misread the scene of life. For what was he doing but going around and killing the disciples of the King of Heaven? And if you're going to make a blunder, that is doing it on a grand scale. That was Saul of Tarsus. And in his conversion, it was God who did the work. It's interesting to compare verses 13 and 14 with verses 15 and 16. For in 13 and 14, Paul is the subject of every verb. I was preaching, I was destroying, I was persecuting, I was zealous, I was advanced. In verses 15 and 16, God is the subject of every verb. For God set me apart from birth and called me by his grace. It was God who pleased to reveal his son to me. God converted me, says Saul. God commissioned me. God sent me out with the gospel. God gave me the gospel in that revelation of Jesus Christ. So the evidence from before his conversion and the evidence from his conversion show that it is not man's gospel he is preaching. It's not any gospel he has received from man, but it's a gospel of divine intervention. But what about since his conversion? Oh, well, straight after my conversion, he says, I went off to Arabia for 3 years. I didn't go back to Jerusalem. I didn't consult with the Christians. I went off into the desert. And after 3 years, then I went up to Jerusalem. And I consulted with Peter for 15 days. Well, I didn't consult with him, I just got acquainted with him. I met him, that's what the word means. I just sought him out so as to find out who he was and put a face in his name and my face on my name so that we'd know each other. And I did bump into James when I was there. And then I shot through to Cilicia and Syria. Syria and Cilicia for another 11 years. That is, in the first 14 years of my Christian experience, I had spent 15 days with the Apostle Peter. I hardly got my gospel from him. I got it out of the road to Damascus. That's where I got it. And I found it and thought it through in my own experience, and I preached it widely. I tell not a lie, he says. Indeed, it's good testimony to the fact that he's concerned for the truth that he even bothers recording those 15 days with Peter. For they really would not be significant in his life and development. And the people in Judea, the churches down around Jerusalem, they didn't know me except by reputation. They used to say, the bloke who used to persecute us is now preaching the faith he used to try and destroy. But they didn't know me. And so since my conversion, just as well as before and in my conversion, I have got no authority other than the authority of God. That is where the gospel comes from. This gospel is God's gospel I'm proclaiming. All right, if that is the case, if it is an independent gospel, is it another gospel then, Paul? You want to stand as the messenger of God? Okay, stand as the messenger of God. But what do you do when we find that what you're saying God says and what Peter says that God says disagree with each other? No, they don't, says Paul. The gospel I preach may be independent of the Jerusalemite Christians, but it's not in any disagreement with them. Because after 14 years, I did go up to Jerusalem. And I went up and sought out the leaders of the church, the elders, the pillars of the church, or whatever you want to call them. They don't matter much to me, because I'm actually independent of them, he's saying. But I found them out. Now, he went there not because he was sent for. He went there because God revealed it to him to go. And he went and laid before the elders the gospel that he preached to the Gentiles, verse 2 of chapter 2. Here was a test case then. But the test case went one step further, because when I went up there, I took with me a bloke called Titus. And Titus was a Gentile convert. So I not only laid before the leaders of the church the gospel to the Gentiles, but I also had an example of a Gentile Christian with me. And what did the Jerusalemite church do face to face with a Gentile gospel and a Gentile convert? They offered to me the right hand of fellowship. Oh, certainly some false brethren came and they tried to overcome our freedom in Jesus Christ. They tried to have poor Titus circumcised. But we wouldn't give in to that, not for a moment. We would not allow Titus to be compelled to be circumcised, because such a thing would have compromised the very truth of the gospel. Circumcision was too important an issue in the subject of Titus. And so these false brethren were shown to be false by the actions we took concerning Titus. And the true leaders of the church, so-called Peter, James and John, they offered to us the right hand of fellowship. They added nothing to the gospel that we preached, because we were in full agreement with them. They perceived that the one and the same God that was working through us for the Gentiles was working through them for the Jews. And so they just praised God and were happy to work with us. So our gospel is in full agreement with the Jerusalem Christians, while being totally independent of the Jerusalem Christians. So we mustn't be setting Paul against Peter, the Gentile gospel against the Jewish gospel, Paul against Jesus, for it is God's message of Jesus that Paul is proclaiming. And it is in this context of controversy and attacks and defence that the great key issues are clarified. The gospel of God, God's gospel, is not two but one, is not dependent upon men, cannot be changed, altered, cannot be improved upon, but must be maintained and faithfully taught. It can be found in Peter and it can be found in Paul. And next week I'm going to seek to declare that gospel with the second half of chapter 2. For when Peter and Paul have a slight controversy over the subject of eating, the issue of what the gospel really is about, the contents of the gospel, becomes absolutely clear. The truth of the gospel Paul stands for, even in opposition to Peter on one occasion, as we see in the second half of the chapter. Now, I won't go on to be talking next week on the subject of Paul and his authority, which is the context in which that incident occurs. But on the assumption that you're here and you've heard that that's the background of it, then next week we'll be just looking at that issue of eating with the Gentiles or not eating with the Gentiles, because from that issue alone you can understand what the gospel of Jesus is all about. And so next week is a marvellous one to be inviting your friends who do not know the gospel of Jesus Christ to have it explained to them. Because the second half of chapter 2 is a marvellous statement about the nature of that gospel. But yet, lest you feel disappointed that you don't hear it tonight, you get it also in the subject of Titus and his circumcision. For that too is a matter of the truth of the gospel. It was God's grace by which we are saved. Compelling Titus to be circumcised would destroy God's grace. You'll notice what he says there in verse 4. This matter arose because some of the false brethren had infiltrated our ranks to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. We did not give in to them for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. The truth of the gospel was at stake in Titus being compelled to be circumcised. Our freedom in Christ was at stake in the compulsion of Titus to be circumcised. For the gospel is the gospel of the grace of God, the mercy and forgiveness of God, as we see in chapter 1, verse 4 last week, And as we see in chapter 1, verse 15, when Paul himself is called according to the grace of God, it's all about his mercy and forgiveness, and therefore it's not about our works. You cannot merit forgiveness. You cannot earn generosity. The two things are mutually exclusive. If Titus has to be circumcised, then he has earned something. If we have to do anything in order to be saved, then we are not saved by God's grace. We are saved by our efforts. But, says Paul, we are saved by God's grace, not by our efforts. And you can't have both. So the title of next week's sermon is Faith Plus Anything Equals Nothing. You can't have faith and works. It is one or the other. You see, the gospel is the gospel of Christ in chapter 1, verse 7 and chapter 1, verse 16. See, what did Paul see out on the road to Damascus? He saw Jesus. That's what he saw. That was the revelation. If Jesus saves us, we do not save ourselves. You can't have it both ways. Paul had tried to save himself all through his Pharisaic days. And on the road to Damascus, he stood condemned. It is Jesus who saves, not obedience to the law of circumcision, or the law of eating, or any law. It was Paul who stood for the gospel and its truth, and who preserved its truth for us. And I wish to warn you, brothers and sisters, tonight to be very wary of criticising him and of knocking him and of attacking him and of doubting him. For unless you're Jewish, your salvation depends on the gospel that he preached. And if he was wrong, you are in very deep water. Very, very deep water. But worse still, if he was wrong, Peter was wrong also, for they're in full agreement. And if Paul and Peter are wrong and you are right, then I'd suggest that you're not a Christian, because Christ was wrong also. Well, you want to ask questions or make comments? Brad? Brad asked the question. He says, Jesus spent 3 years trying to bang the gospel into the heads of the disciples. Did Paul, with limited success, I may add, in most occasions, did Paul grasp all that it took them 3 years to grasp hold of in the few seconds out on the road to Damascus? Is that the question? Yep, the answer is yes. You see, they lived at very different times. Very, very different times. Didn't take me 3 years to become a Christian. Many people here didn't take them 3 years to become Christians, and we didn't even have the blinding light and all the rest of it. I know people who become Christians in a very short period of time, without any blinding lights, and without 3 years of divine teaching. The apostles lived before the crucifixion, and before the resurrection, and before the gift of the Holy Spirit, all of which are fairly important facts to have at your disposal before you can understand what the gospel of Jesus is about. Paul lives after those events, and when he sees Jesus risen from the dead, then the whole of his viewpoint of life is known to be absolutely wrong. Not just marginally wrong, which is what the apostles kept on thinking they were. In fact, they thought they were basically right. They really thought they were marginally wrong. They were fundamentally wrong, but they couldn't see it. But on the road to Damascus, Paul knew that, whatever else he knew, he was fundamentally and radically wrong. He knew who the Lord of heaven and earth was at that moment. Well, it took the disciples years to find that out. They didn't know Jesus was the Lord of heaven and earth. So the whole gospel presentation to Paul was of a different nature than that that was presented to the apostles over the 3 years. And it comes to us with much greater clarity and simplicity than it does to the apostles, or even than it did to Paul, really. Thank you. Russell adds to a very helpful point, that's quite right, that it actually came on the apostles in the same way, the other apostles, as it came on Paul, for it all fell into place on the day of Pentecost, in a moment, in a flash. Yep. Yes, Rick. That Paul was taught by the Lord 3 years in Arabia. Yes, some people suggest that Paul was taught by the Lord for 3 years in Arabia. The only reference we have to his 3 years in Arabia is there. That is the sum total of the knowledge we have of his Arabian stay. Certainly, whatever else he's trying to say here is he's trying to say, I didn't learn it from any men out in Arabia. Now, did he have mystic experiences in Arabia? Well, by and large, he's opposed to mystic experiences in the rest of his writings, so that is unlikely. Although he does refer in 2 Corinthians to the man who's caught up into the third heaven. We don't know, presumably that is himself, but we don't know when and where that happened. And he puts no store in it. He doesn't think that's important. When you read the arguments of Paul, what you find is that he consistently finds his understanding of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament. And so over and over again he says, as it is written, and quotes the Old Testament. And I suggest that the place that he learnt it in his 3 years in Arabia is more likely to have been found in the first 39 books of the Bible, which we call the Old Testament. Because he is absolutely, he's steeped in it. And once he has learnt that Jesus, who died, is risen, that is the key which opens up to him the whole Old Testament. Tony? So this point is that because Paul had a revelation of Jesus Christ, subsequent to the great Pentecost experience of the first revelation of Jesus Christ, that some people would suggest that Jesus goes on revealing himself to prophets in every age and generation, and asks, can we from Paul either argue for or against that happening? That is? Well, for a question I've not reflected on or thought on ever before, which gives me a few moments to think now, you can't argue from the is to what will be. That God did this once does not mean that God will or will not do it another time, necessarily. Right? That the Ethiopian eunuch, that Philip was shown the Ethiopian eunuch and then zotted off to the other side of the countryside later on, that happened once, doesn't mean that we should always be looking over our shoulder ready to see an Ethiopian eunuch popping along, reading Isaiah 53 and saying, good sir, what must I do to be saved? If you ever do bump into anyone, I've got a good line for you to use with them. It's all found in Acts 8 and 9, 8 there. But you see, just because it happens once doesn't mean it's going necessarily to happen again, or that it can't. You must never say God cannot do this. God made the Balaam's ass speak the word of God. Well, he may do that to you too someday. You can't rule out that possibility, can you? Yet you needn't be looking for it every time you go to a donkey farm. It just says nothing one way or the other. However, I would expect that we will not be seeing it again. Because that Paul was not only just called to himself, but he was called to Jesus Christ to become a Christian, but he was actually commissioned to the work of preaching to the Gentiles. That was a major step in the program of God, which we take for granted because we're Gentiles. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, the only believers in God were Jews. The only ones who could believe in God were Jews. And if you became a believer in God, then you had to become a Jew. There was no other way you could ever be in relationship with God than be a Jew. That was their thinking for centuries. That's their whole mentality and outlook. Now we're being told that all kinds of Gentiles can become believers in God, and that some of the Jews actually aren't believers in God. That is a radical step in thinking. That's an enormous leap forward. And it is understandable how God can raise up a special servant to overcome that jump in the spread of the gospel. Now, I think that's what the book of Acts is saying, where it says the gospel is to be preached to the Jews, that's simple, and to the Samaritans, that's extraordinary, and to the Gentiles, that's unthinkable. And when you read through the book of Acts, that's what happens. Firstly, the Jews, then some Samaritans sneak in, but we're a bit unsure about that until the apostles from Jerusalem come and check them out. And then, lo and behold, Cornelius gets converted right against Peter's wishes. He didn't want to see Cornelius converted, did he? He had to have two or three visions. He had to have an angel coming and speaking to him. And he had to have Cornelius and his family all drop down in front of him, filled with the Holy Spirit and speaking in tongues and all kinds of things, praising God in their tongues. It's only when that happens that Peter says, well, I think maybe we should baptize them. What do you think about it? It's an enormous leap for them to be making. Enormous leap. And that God therefore appoints a special servant of an extraordinary nature, as the Apostle Paul really was as a man, to that specific task, to establish that point, I can understand. And I don't think I therefore am expecting another one to come up. Because unless we're now going to start preaching the gospel to the Martians or something, it's that kind of unthinkability that is required before I'd expect it to happen again. Corinthians 15 verse 8, as Stephen has rightly pointed out for us, does imply that he is the last one. But it needn't be, it just means that I might be the last one so far. However, he sees his birth as an abnormality, not as a normality. And therefore I don't think we should be expecting another. Russell? Sorry? Yes? I thought you were going to ask that. Yes. Galatians 2:2, the last phrase says, for fear that I was running or had run my race in vain. Now the whole drift of the passage is that he's not under their authority, and yet that verse, that phrase sounds as if it may be that he is. That's not why I go back to my notes, because I had this question prepared. It's commonly taken that what he's saying is, not that I have done the wrong thing and I want to check it out, but that the Judaizers were so attacking the gospel that I thought of going up there. I received revelation from God to go up there to establish with them that we were doing the same thing, so that my work amongst the Gentiles would not run in vain. Right? That is the normal way in which it's taken. However, I have been taught by the bishop in Parramatta to think that it's actually a fulfilment of Isaiah chapter 49. Because in Isaiah chapter 49, the suffering servant, he also is set apart before birth, as Paul was, and he also does his work and is concerned about it running in vain, and I think it's an allusion to Isaiah 49. That's part of the reason why I didn't spell it out in a sermon, because it then gets very complex, but you might like to look up that passage to check it out. Isaiah 49, verse 4 is the phrase, I think, but the whole section you need to look at. Want to ask other questions or make other comments? Well, yes. Why did Paul circumcise Timothy? Is that the question? Because circumcision was a matter of complete indifference to him. That's why. It didn't matter whether he was or he wasn't. And yet it was not a matter of indifference to other people. And so he was happy to do it, provided he didn't have to do it. Now the key word in the Titus event, for example, is the word compelled. In fact, he may have circumcised Titus too, He didn't say that he didn't, and I haven't said that he didn't either. What he didn't do was, he didn't allow Titus to be circumcised because of compulsion. It's like baptism. If you should say to me, Philip, you must be baptised by full immersion as an adult believer in order to be saved, I will refuse to be baptised. If you should say to me, Philip, in order to be in fellowship with a congregation of God's people here, you need adult baptism by full immersion, because people have got some sensitive consciences about it and they're a bit worried about it. I said, well, I don't have to be. No, I mean, you don't have to be, but if you'd like to be, it would be a nice expression of fellowship and it would keep the brethren all happy. I said, oh, sure, show me the swimming pool. Because it doesn't matter to me whether I'm baptised or I'm not baptised. Once, 10 times, 1,000 times, it really doesn't matter to me one way or the other. But as soon as you say I must be, I refuse to be. Now, do you understand why people think that he's a bit odd and hypocritical and twisted in his views? Because it's a subtlety of mind at that point, isn't it? But the gospel hangs on that. It really does hang on that. The truth of the gospel was at stake in the circumcision of Titus. Because what they wanted to do was place Titus under circumcision so that he would be under the law, so that your salvation would be earned by you, by obedience to the law of Moses. That can't be, says Paul. We're saved by God's mercy through the sacrifice of Jesus on our behalf. He has fulfilled the law for us. He has become the curse of the law on our behalf. I cannot now fulfill the law without destroying Jesus. And so he will not allow Titus to be compelled to be circumcised. Whether or not Titus was circumcised, we won't know until we go to heaven, and I'm not sure that I'll ask him then, but if I bump into him, I suppose I'll give it a whirl, because I've wondered for some years now. Well now, friends, next week, you see, we'll be looking at this compulsion question again, because around that little word, compulsion, lies two methods of salvation. One, the Christian method of Jesus Christ, who died on our behalf. Two, the moralistic method of good works, of religious works, of obeying God through the law of the God. One method, Jesus, leads to heaven. The other method, the law, leads to hell. They are radically different. Yet if ever there's a view that the average Australian holds, whoever he may be, it is that Christianity teaches that good men go to heaven and that what you've got to do is obey the law of God and the Ten Commandments and that. And so when you come to the second half of chapter 2 of Galatians, you are striking right at the very heart of Australian religiosity. You're calling into question all that is fundamental to their understanding of what God is about, because you uphold Jesus as the full, perfect, sufficient sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. And as you uphold him, so men will be drawn through him to God the Father. But the reason Paul puts it into Galatians 2 is not so as to preach an evangelistic sermon, of which I will do next week, but so as to demonstrate what we've been looking at tonight, that his gospel is the authentic gospel, the only authentic gospel, for there is only one gospel, because it's God's gospel. Before we pray, Marianne's going to come and sing to us, if I can catch you later about a brother. All right?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.